thank you for tuning in to the Best of Movie Geeks United, a collection of some of our most memorable conversations from our archives. Tonight, three outstanding directors. Lawrence Kasdan, the writer-director of films like The Big Chill and Grand Canyon, came on our show to discuss his latest film, Darling Companion. He's followed by an hour-long conversation with Joel Schumacher, the man behind the lens on such films as Falling Down and The Lost Boys. And finally, we end with Todd Phillips, one of the most successful directors working today, who's responsible for the massively successful Hangover trilogy.
Mr. Kasdan, as we discussed earlier, I mean, he's written some of the great adventure films,
right,
with Raiders of the Lost Ark and Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. But he's also written and directed some of the best ensemble films you'll
right.
ever see. The Big Chill, Grand Canyon, The Accidental Tourist.
Yeah. Body Heat. Don't forget Body Heat.
Body Heat, yes, Body Heat. I Love You to Death.
Yeah, these are all good.
No. I was telling you, Jerry, I Love You to Death.
Thank you. Sweet Jamie.
Silverado.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mumford has its fans, too.
Yeah.
And so he's back with a movie called Darling Companion with Diane Keaton, the first time they've worked together. Kevin Kline, who returns for something like the sixth collaboration with him.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Richard Jenkins, Diane Wiest, Sam Shepard. It's got a great ensemble, as all of his films do. It opens in limited release on the 20th, and it opens wider and wider every week after for about 6 or so weeks.
Oh, cool.
So here is Mr. Kasdan and his wife, who also serves as co-producer and co-writer on the film, Meg, talking about Darling Companion and a lot of other things related to their filmmaking careers.
Hi, Dad.
Yeah, ask Mom if you remember to pick up my stuff at the cleaners.
Turn around!
What? You gotta go back! I saw something!
Wait, Mom, are you sure about this?
It was... Here you go.
We're not getting the dogs, right?
What are you naming him?
Freeway.
Freeway! Freeway!
You lost the dog while you were talking on the phone! Something wrong?
The dog's run off.
Oh, shoot!
What's the emergency, Joe?
We lost our dog!
Freeway!
Don't you know how much that dog means to me?
Yeah, I like him too. I'm just not obsessed with him.
You know more about your patients than you do about your own family.
We've done everything we can.
Would you be leaving if I were missing?
That's ridiculous.
Freeway's alive.
What are you talking about?
The women in the family, they have a gift. We see things. Do you see him? Is he all right? I see trees.
Wow, that really pinpoints it.
So what's the plan?
Russell is very cheerful. Can he keep up with you? Why do you think he's so cheerful?
Look at that! Did he bite?
No, they ram. Oh. Little dogs control them just by yapping.
Honey, did it work?
No.
Darling companion.
We haven't lost a person. We've lost a dog.
Love is love. Doesn't matter if it's a dog.
My shoulder dislocated. You're going to have to put it back.
No, I cannot.
Once you ignore me, no matter how much I scream.
Stop, you're killing me.
Okay.
I told you to ignore me.
Farmington's Freeway really wants to come in, but he's got to hear a friendly voice.
Okay, what?
Now you know you'll never be abandoned. Love will always light our land. I can depend on
things that bug me about you. Never meant anything compared with how much I love you.
So I guess my first question to you is, this is the first film that you've directed in 9 years, and
yeah.
We've missed you very much. So why the hiatus?
I've missed myself. Yeah, it's never intended. You never expect the break to be that long. I adapted a novel by Richard Russo called The Risk Pool, and I was going to do it with Tom Hanks.
Hmm.
And I spent a lot of time writing that, and we were edging toward production, and then the whole thing fell apart the way these things often do. And the kind of movies that I make have become more and more difficult to get made, as you can see from your local movie page. And so I've worked on two or three other things during that time. I did a couple writing jobs. And then a couple years ago, we started working on this, and it took us a while to write the script, and then pretty briefly to make the film. But but time passes rapidly. There's no question about it. It's frustrating, but not a hell of a lot you can do about it.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned how movies have kind of changed a bit.
Yeah.
And this is the first movie that you've done that has been independently produced. And I would imagine a great number of your films, if you tried to make them today.
That's absolutely right.
Would have to go the same route, or they'd
be
compromised.
That's exactly right. You can't make them in the studio system the way... I was lucky enough to come in a period when it was possible. And I started directing at the beginning of the 80s and was able to make movies for 20 years in the studio system. And as you say, those movies simply are not made by studios anymore.
So tell me if this was, did this feel like a different filmmaking experience for you than what you're accustomed to?
It felt different in some ways in that we had very little money and very little time. But the process is the same, and when you drive up in the morning, even though you've got this tiny little budget, you're shocked to see that you still have the trucks and you still have the people. And we had the, you know, world-class cast, and these people all agreed to do this for very little money. So in that way, it wasn't different. You know, I've been really blessed to work with the best actors in the world for 30 years, and that didn't change with this low-budget independent film.
Well, that's what's very special about your work. It's kind of a common thread that you assemble such exceptional ensembles in all of your films and pull such incredible performances out of such great actors. But tell me what that process is. For instance, in this film, do you allow for a period where they can get to know each other and rehearse prior?
Well, you know, there was a unique moment at the beginning of The Big Chill, which is in 1982. We were preparing that movie in beginning of 83, and we actually rehearsed for 4 weeks, and those people who were all strangers did get to know each other, and they got to play friends after 4 weeks of rehearsal. I have always had some rehearsal, but never anything approaching that, and it's become harder and harder as the economics of the business change. And a lot of people don't want to do rehearsal, and not me, but a lot of films have no interest in rehearsal because the directors don't really want to sit in a room with the actors and discuss the text because they haven't got a clue what the text is about anyway. You know, they're shooters. But this film, we were able to have 3 days of rehearsal. Considered myself lucky for that. We didn't have everybody. But it's enormously valuable to me because I get to hear the script. I get to hear how different people see it. It's always different than you heard it in your head. It's you see where there are problems. You see where things could be improved. And we had a little bit of that on this, but a lot of that had to happen on the fly. Our schedule was very short. Our prep was even shorter. And we just had to make do.
Yeah. Well, when you make a film and even write a film, I mean, there's what the film is about, and then there's what the movie is really about.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you don't discover that until after you're done shooting.
Yes.
But what have you discovered about what this movie is really about for you?
I think, you know, you're always trying to find that. For me, movies are metaphors. And trying to find the metaphor that lets you talk about the things you're interested in. And the search for this dog was a vessel for Meg and I to talk about this issue of companionship. Now, it came out of a real experience, which for me has always been the best way for these screenplays to work, you know, that they come out of something real that happens, and then you, just as you just described, you discover what they mean to you as you live through them. And in searching, we actually lost a dog and searched for a dog and found a dog. And then when Meg suggested we write a screenplay about it, it became a vessel, a vehicle for talking about companionship, talking about the ways that relationships can fray over time. Even the best marriage can become worn and tired if just from familiarity.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of kind of relationships in the movie. There's brand new marriage, and there's a new exciting romantic relationship between Mark Duplass and Isla Dzur. And then there's this new relationship that starts with middle-aged people, Diane Wiest and Richard Jenkins. And, of course, the central relationship is this marriage that has gone on for a long time, where children have been raised, where the nest is emptied, and where a dog has come in and taken over some of those feelings for the Diane Keaton character. And when her husband loses the dog, it has a huge impact on her, and it throws into relief some of the problems they're having in their marriage.
Did you find that what you were writing was kind of truthful to what becoming a dog owner illuminated to you about yourself and your relationship?
Definitely. We had had a dog when the boys, we have two boys, and when they were growing up, we had a dog. And I don't think I was a terribly good dog owner. I was very concentrated on my work, and he came into the house sort of obliquely, and I don't think I ever really welcomed him into my heart. And he, after a period of time, he was with us for a while, and he passed away. We didn't have a dog for a while, and then we considered it, and then as the boys left the house, Meg and I considered having a dog, and we avoided looking at the adoption sites because, you know, you're liable to adopt a dog a week if you look at those sites. Mm-hmm. They're just so appealing. But there was one dog that came through. Meg was getting notices, and I looked at his face, and Meg looked at his face, and we said we had to go down and see him. He was in a shelter in South Central Los Angeles. And we went down there, and we fell in love with this dog and adopted him about 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. After we'd had him for 2 years, and I fell in love with this dog, and we committed to him in a way, I think, that we had not with the earlier dog. And after a couple of years, he got lost. We were in the Rockies, we had left him there with a friend while we went to a wedding, and he spooked on a hike and got lost. And we looked everywhere for him. We came back there, we put up signs, we went on the radio, everything you see in the movie. And I think that I was shocked by how much I wanted that dog back and how much I cared about him, how much he'd entered our lives in the 2 years we've had him. And I think that's all in the movie, is the surprise of really caring about another species.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's that emotional investment.
Yeah.
And I was actually going to ask you about something related to that in terms of your writing career, because you've obviously written screenplays for your own films, but also for others that have been enormously successful. But when you write for a project that you're not directly involved in on a directorial level, is there a different kind of emotional investment involved?
Yes. And I would say there's two different... I haven't done a lot of writing for other people since Raiders and Empire and Jedi. Mm-hmm. When I was doing those were my first jobs in the business, and I was still trying to become a director. But to get the opportunity to write Raiders of the Lost Ark as my first job in the business, I had sold two original screenplays by then, but that was an incredible situation to be working with George Lucas and Steven Spielberg at that time,
mm-hmm.
and to come up with this story and have it work out so well for everybody.
Yeah.
So I think there was no, I was full on, absolutely committed to those things. I have done a few jobs over the years, and in this 9-year period I did a few jobs where it's not like that. I don't feel any cynicism about it, but it's a job of work. It's trying to be a professional, and where you come in, and I've worked on a few movies that have gotten made, and I haven't even tried to get credit because I didn't feel that my contribution warranted credit or that I necessarily wanted my name on the movie.
The art is a source of unspeakable power, and it has to be researched.
And it will be, I assure you, Dr. Brody, Dr. Jones,
We have top men working on it right now.
Who?
Hey, what happened? You don't look very happy.
Fools. Bureaucratic fools.
What'd they say?
They don't know what they've got there.
Well, I know what I've got here. Come on. Buy a drink. You know. A drink?
You know, I have to ask you about just recently we had the pleasure of welcoming Carol Littleton to the show, and that's a collaboration you've returned to something like 8 or 9 times.
Yes,
and she was incredible, obviously.
She's
but what
an amazing person, one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met.
What clicks between the two of you, do you think?
When I was looking for an editor for Body Heat, I wanted to find a woman because the movie was so sexual, and I thought it would be really helpful to have a woman's point of view when we went to cut the movie. Mm-hmm. And someone introduced me to Carol. She had worked with the Hikes on French Postcards, and she knew people I knew. And the second I met her, I was totally taken with her. She was such a mensch and such a wise person. This was 30 years ago. Since then, we've done 9 movies together, and I would trust her judgment on anything. She's centered, and she's full-hearted and real. She's like a wise person, and it's just a joy to go in every day and sit with her and discuss and debate what you're doing and saying, what is this scene about? And she always does a cut of her own, and then we come in and discuss that, and she's wide open to change and to the constantly changing shape that a movie has. And it's such an invigorating conversation to have, and you have it for months.
Yeah. Just one last question. I know I have to let you go, but I even talked to Miss Littleton about this film because it's one of my top 5 all-time favorites, and that's Accidental Tourist.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about kind of the delicacy of tone
in
that movie. Was that a challenge?
It was, but it was very... it was an emotionally satisfying movie in every way. But one of the things that changed for me forever there was that this crew, which was a fabulous crew, but they all are, really. I've been so lucky. I love movie crews. I'm amazed by the skills they bring every day and in all kinds of conditions. But that movie was so delicate. You're absolutely right. And the tone was so delicate. And this crew was so respectful and nurturing of that filmmaking. When it was over, I was overwhelmed, actually, by it. And I think it changed my relationship to crews forever. I was so taken by the sensitivity they had brought to that subject matter. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing that you asked that question, because that was a seminal experience for me.
Well, the movie means a whole lot to me, as do so many of your movies. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Beth, what are you doing?
I'm looking for those night vision glasses I got you for Christmas. They're probably still in the same box.
Beth, you have to get some rest. You heard Miss Luminitska. Let me get you Xanax.
You think it's impossible Carmen might actually know something you don't?
About Freeway? Doubtful, unless she kidnapped him.
She's given me hope. Maybe she has a gift, and unlike you, I don't think I know everything about everything.
What? Why are you turning on me? I didn't commit a crime.
There are a few pivotal moments in a person's life where one reacts exactly right or completely wrong.
I forgot the whistle.
But that's not what I'm talking about.
This is a difficult time for you, for both of us. And especially for a woman, there are physical changes that affect everything.
Oh, tell me about being a woman.
I think that the anger you're feeling is not actually about me. It's hormonal.
No. It's not menopause. It actually is about you.
He's made defining movies, and if you look at that period of the 80s, St. Elmo's Fire, followed by The Lost Boys, going into the 90s, we're talking about Flatliners,
Falling Down, which is a
Falling
great
Down.
Favorite.
And the two really good Grissom movies, The Client
and The Time to Kill.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. And he brought to the world Colin Farrell for it was a long time.
Look,
his best role, Tigerland.
He's brought to the world a lot of people.
Yeah.
And you even mentioned The Client. He entrusted the lead of his movie, The Client, to an untested actor in Brad Renfro.
Yeah.
You know? And it was a great performance, sadly. I mean, his life was cut far too short, but he's defined by his discoveries.
That's right.
And the opportunities he gives people. St. Elmo's Fire is a prime example of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Falling Down is great. Time to Kill, 8mm, Tigerland, Phone Booth, Veronica Guerin is a great favorite of ours.
Yeah, that is a good one.
And my favorite film in his resume is Flawless with De Niro.
That's a good film.
Yeah.
I like that film.
An original screenplay by him that he also directed. It's a great movie. And he also has an upcoming film this summer called 12. That he'll be discussing with us tonight as well. So without further ado, here is Mr. Joel Schumacher. Enjoy, everybody.
I can't remember who met who first or who fell in love with who first. All I can remember is the seven of us always together.
Not just infatuation, Kevin. She's not just a girl. She's the only evidence of God that I can find on this entire planet.
Where did you meet Wendy again?
Prison.
Hi, Felicia. How you doing? Me? Oh, you know, it ain't easy being me.
You know all those nights we stayed up talking? How come you never made a pass at me?
I'm gonna get you a red, lacy baby doll like.
Alex, I'm very happy in your old pajamas.
Well, I'm happy when you're out of my old pajamas.
Alec is becoming a Republican and he wants to get married.
Oh my God.
Do you ever feel like you're not accomplishing anything at all?
I think I'm in touch with that emotion.
You're not gonna believe how hot a hand it's gonna be.
You wanted to make movies from an early age. A very early age. And
Seven.
I was wow.
Seven. I grew up in a, let's see, what can I say? Like, not the highest socioeconomic structure. And one of those neighborhoods that made, you know, the country great. A lot of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific people. You know, definitely working, definitely blue collar and working class. And it was great. But the great thing in our neighborhood, because this is going to be so hard for the two of you to even comprehend. I grew up before television. I know it's incomprehensible. But, and so we had radio, but as you can probably tell from my films, a little bit sort of into visual sensations. You know, comic books, which of course are just like storyboards, really. The comic books and the movies were what I had. And my mother and I, my father died when I was a little kid. And my mother and I lived on the first floor of our building, and there was an empty lot where we played baseball, and right at the edge of the empty lot was a huge movie, the back doors of a huge movie palace called the Sunnyside Movies in Long Island City. And I lived very much, because after my father died, my mother was out of work 6 days a week and three nights a week. And she was a wonderful woman, but she wasn't around. And I was like the kid in Cinema Paradiso. I just lived in the movie theater and just watched movies over and over again. And when I was seven, I never liked kid movies at all. I don't think I always understood what I was seeing, but I always liked noir and much more adult fare.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was a great golden era of movies that I grew up on. But I saw, which I later, I knew nothing about these things, but I saw Great Expectations when I was seven. And I didn't know about who David Lean was. I didn't even know what directors were. I knew nothing. And I certainly didn't know it was one of the most famous books Charles Dickens wrote. But the first image of the movie is Pip in a graveyard.
Right.
And so there's this little boy, you know, without a family, who is in a graveyard. And it was the first visual image I'd ever seen that I'm like, oh, like, just like me. You know, when you relate, with the moment you started relating to things on the screen. And then, of course, he's a young boy with great expectations. So, and after that, I couldn't sleep a lot. I remember I was haunted by images in the movie, which are still to this day, I mean, these great archetypical images, you know, they're just stunning. And great actors and the way David Lean shot things. And that had a very visceral effect on me. And very shortly after that, probably when I was around 9, I started making up stories. And then I built, and I don't know where I would have seen this. I must have seen it in a movie. But I went to the library and I got a book on marionettes, and I built marionette theater. And I made my own puppets. And this served two purposes. One, it made me really popular in the neighborhood because I got invited to every birthday party and everything. But I think I was really trying to make up movies. You know, I write the story, and I would do the scenery, and I even had a little portable, you know, phonograph where I would put on music when it was necessary. And I think I was trying to make movies.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't seen theater yet, you know. So, yeah, I started with that dream very young. I had no idea this was going to happen. I mean,
That's part of what I wanted to ask you related to the early influences you had, the filmmakers that inspired you once you became conscious that there was a director behind the lens. So I suppose David Lean was one of them, obviously.
Well, of course. You know, then I became, you know, as I got in my teens and started to really understand, you know, then when television came along, we didn't have one for a long time, but when it did, or I was at one of my friends' houses and they had it, you know, you knew who Walt Disney was and Alfred Hitchcock because they were on television.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Weekly. You know, they had a weekly show. And so they were personas, so you knew that they were making these things. But, you know, certainly when I was a kid, I had no idea that I was watching, you know, Elia Kazan and John Huston and John Ford and, you know, on and on and on and on. I mean, it was a fantastic, Vincent Minnelli and Stanley Donen and of course, Billy Wilder, mm-hmm. who ultimately became my favorite director. And also Fritz Lang and, who some people pronounce Wong, but I don't know. I mean, Fritz Lang is fine with me.
Yeah, it's good with us too.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine.
And,
whatever you call them, the movies are great.
Right, and there were so many more. You know, I mean, it's Victor Fleming did Gone with the Wind and Wizard of Oz, I think, in the same year.
Yeah.
And no one remembers his name. If you ask anyone who directed Gone with the Wind, no one knows.
Yeah.
And so, you know, of course, these were movies that were, look, the 1939 movies were made the year I was born. So, mm-hmm. but they were always replaying them. You know, they would bring in movies to the, there were three movie theaters in our neighborhood, and then, so I was watching some of the great American movies of, you know, this golden era, and of course, you know, the gods and goddesses of acting that were part of the Hollywood machine, you know, and,
yeah.
And, but what happened then was my mother worked in a dress store selling dresses, and right near her, there was this tiny little theater called the Center Theater. And I didn't realize it at the time that it was an art house theater. And it was another movie theater I didn't know about. So I went in there, and there were foreign films.
Mm.
And they had subtitles. And of course, part of it was the great Italian neorealism, which was also, unlike the Hollywood movies, which were quite glamorous in their own way. Even the ones that were trying to be gritty were glamorous, and because it was Hollywood. I was watching, you know, Bicycle Thief and Bellissima and Open City, and those were movies about people who were very real to me.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't just magic creatures on the screen in a world that I never thought I could really ever be part of.
Right.
But these were, you know, stories. And what I was watching was Fellini and De Sica and Jean Renoir. And I was watching, you know, Gerard Philippe and Michel Morgan and, you know, some of the greatest, the Anna Magnani and, you know, some of the greatest European actors. And they also showed Kurosawa,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't know any of these people's names. And I'm sure I was too young to quite understand the subtitles, but it didn't matter. It was just, I still remember, I can remember sitting in those theaters and the effect that these movies had on me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure every director you talk to, whatever their time was, would say the same thing to you. And
yeah, these were major influences. And actually, I mean, you're one of the great directors, and the other great directors from your generation, these were their major influences, too. I mean,
yeah.
You look at 70s cinema, and that's what you have.
Yeah, I mean, it's not only that. You're the same generation as my mom and dad, and they went every day or every weekend to the movies, and especially the art house films you're talking about, the foreign films. Those had a profound effect on their generation because they'd never seen anything like that before. When those started
it was revolutionary.
It was
yeah.
as though, like, the Michelangelo painting, you know, it's like no one's ever seen anything quite like this before in this country.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's astounding.
They still are.
Oh, they're timeless.
No. Yeah, Nick Cage and I were just talking about Kurosawa the other day and Rashomon, and, you know, it's so indelible. We're quoting lines from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't think both of us have seen it in years and years, but...
Just to fast forward.
I even copied the music. I copied some of the Kurosawa sounds
right.
in Tigerland because a traditional score didn't work in Tigerland. And so Nathan Larson and I, there's very little music in Tigerland, but what there is very much, for some reason, even though they're teenagers drafted to go to Vietnam and they're in boot camp, somehow with the swamp and the forest and the woods, and there was something about, you know, all those fabulous Asian sounds. Nathan
mm-hmm.
found the real musicians who play in the subway, the old Asian men. And if you ever see Tigerland, you'll hear it's totally stolen from Kurosawa. But,
wow.
Just
to fast forward just a little bit, so you got into, what was it, costume design before you got into directing?
Well, I got a scholarship you know, my main focus was how could I make some money so my mother could stop working.
Right.
Or didn't have to work as much.
Right.
And so with the urging of some friends, I submitted a portfolio to Parsons, and so I got a scholarship to Parsons School of Design, and they put me, it was a much smaller school, very hard to get in then, had a very famous interior design department and fashion department, and so I got a scholarship, and they put me in the fashion department.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I was working my way through school, doing the windows and the interiors of a very progressive, very hip store called Henry Dandel, which was on 57th Street in those days, and run by a 30-year-old woman president, and which will tell you how advanced that, just that she had that job at that time and was a phenomenal person. And so that store was the center of fashion in Manhattan. Everything else was very, very conservative. And she was ahead of the curve, this was in the early 60s. She was ahead of the curve of what was the explosion that was going to happen, which was happening in Europe, but ultimately would come to the United States. And so that was the center of all the fashion people. And everybody said to me in school and also at the store was, you should get a job in fashion when you got out of school, Joel. You should be a designer. In quotes, you will make a lot of money, end quote. And those words meant to me, I could get my mother out of that apartment. I could do things for her so I did get high paying jobs in fashion. Unfortunately, just as I graduated and that happened, my mother died suddenly. Mm-hmm. And so that was. And then I was kind of, I was already a drug addict because it was the 60s. And then I didn't like fashion, and I wanted to make movies and ever since I was a kid. But Hollywood seemed so far. It just seemed ridiculous. How was I ever going to work in the movies? And so I crashed and burned in the fashion business because of drugs, and also I really didn't have a burning desire to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got off hard drugs in 1970, a very close friend, who was kind of my first non-druggy friend when I stopped shooting up, and he was the youngest producer of television commercials at Ben and Bolt, and we both had dreams about going to Hollywood and kind of encouraged each other. And he had a very close friend named Dominic Dunn. Dominic Dunn was not a novelist then. He was a producer. And he was doing a film of Joan Didion is his sister-in-law, and John Gregory Dunn was his brother.
Right.
One of Joan's great books is played as a lady.
Right.
And they were doing a film. Frank Perry was the director. Tony Perkins, the Jew, said, well, we're in it. And I met them all and then stalked Dominic Dunn. I just wouldn't give up. And I wanted to be a TA. I said I would carry coffee, I would do anything.
Right.
But I have, because when I got off hard drugs, I thought, okay, my whole life's fucked up. I have to go back to, to zero and start again. And I thought, I said to my friends, I'm going to go to Hollywood and become a movie director. And they thought I was on drugs again. And But I really need to say that. And then, so here's this chance. Dominic was making a movie in Hollywood with Tony Perkins and Tuesday Weld and Frank Perry, and they were going to do this, and I had to be a part of it. So he eventually took me in to meet Frank, and the three of us were in the office, and they said, look, we don't need anyone to carry coffee. We have plenty of, there'll be plenty of people in L.A. to do that. What we need is, we need a really quick and cheap costume designer. And because I had a bad rep for professionalism in the fashion business, but a good rep for talent, that I said, sure. So I think we made the movie for $1 million, and it was Dominic who really brought me to Hollywood. And unfortunately, Dominic died last year, but we stayed close friends. And I think he was happier for my success than even I was. He was so proud, and I'm glad he got to see that. And
so you also were encouraged a lot by Woody Allen, I understand.
Well, yes, because the third or fourth movie I did costumes on was Sleeper.
Right.
Sleeper. And Woody had a deal with UA in those days with Eric Pleskow and Arthur Krim. You know, it's hard for you in your generation to understand. The Hollywood I came out to was very small and very personal. And you knew everybody by first name. And so Eric and Arthur were legendary, and I mean, I had been watching Woody since I was a busboy in the village when I was, I think, just before I went to Parsons. And I used to go see Woody do stand-up at the Bone Saw. I would save my tips and go see Woody, and, you know, his stand-ups are legendary.
They are,
and I couldn't even believe I was meeting Woody Allen, let alone he hired me. And we became very close friends, and he has really been a mentor, and we're still very close friends now. I see him, you know, for dinner a few times a year,
Let me ask you something about him. I mean, this is off topic, but
he's the one who told me to start writing.
Exactly. Yeah, but as a film director, does Woody Allen have the most enviable career of any film director?
Well,
I tell you why I ask, because it seems
that's
that...
That's a tough question. Well, but for many years, he was like a subsidized artist.
Right.
And he could do, for instance, his deal with UA was he could do anything he wanted. As long as it cost $2 million, it was a comedy, and he was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that was a phenomenal deal. And I think it allowed, sorry, I'm on the streets of New York.
That's quite all right.
Away from these guys.
But he does.
Know, you really know I'm in Manhattan, don't you?
Oh, I love the sound effects. It's
yeah,
great.
We love it. It's great. It makes for great radio. But it does seem like I've always said that Woody Allen has the greatest job in the history of cinema. Anything that he writes will get financed and made.
Yes, I've never asked him if something didn't, but he has written things that I know he's put on the back burner, because I remember one of the ideas he was working on and then he decided not to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know how many of those there are. I've never asked. I will. But he's the one who told me to write, and he also told me I would become a director. And I said, oh, you're just saying that because you like me. And he said, no, I would never encourage you if I didn't think you had talent. He also, during the making of Sleeper, he had very bad communication with Dale Hennessy, who was the great production designer, who did a fabulous job on Sleeper for no money.
Mm-hmm.
But they were such opposite personalities, they just couldn't communicate with each other. And so, you know, Woody encouraged me to sort of help out with some of the sets. But, I mean, it was Dale's genius, but they just couldn't. And he encouraged me to be, you know, also, you really have to understand, Woody's movies at that time were like the high school play. I mean, it was, everybody had to pitch in. I mean, I cut out the nose out of Pink Rubber, sitting on the nose that he and Diane steal.
Right,
I was
right.
sitting on the pavement. That the reason we shot it in Boulder and Denver is because it was very progressive at that time for poured concrete architecture. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that people think are sets in that movie are the real places. And there was the IMK, National Atmospheric Research Center,
right.
which we used as the place where they stole the nose from. And I was sitting in the parking lot cutting out pink noses all day because it was like the high school play. You hold this up, you go get this, you go do that, you cut that out, you know, and everybody was encouraged to participate.
Yeah.
So it was very exciting because I'd worked for Frank Perry, Herb Ross,
mm-hmm.
Paul Mazursky before that, you know, who were very established directors at the time, but they were also, you stayed in your department.
Right.
You know, you weren't asked or encouraged to participate in any way beyond what your job was. And so this was kind of miraculous. And at
mm-hmm.
the same time, I read an interview with Stanley Kubrick that said, my secret is I steal from everyone on the set. And I thought, well, you know, Woody Allen and Stanley Kubrick, if they're doing that, if I ever got to be a director, that's the way to direct.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, of course, by doing that, you know, he got much more out of us than
mm-hmm.
just standing in the department following orders. And
exactly.
Because, you know, you can listen to everybody's suggestions, but you choose which ones you like and don't. So, and I tell that a lot to young directors, you know, just listen to everyone and then take your own counsel. But, and I try to tell the cast and crew at our first production meeting, you know, please don't go home and tell your significant other what I should have done today.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been on those movies as crew where the whole crew sits around and says, if he would just do this and that, it would be so much easier. And that director's not open. And so you're afraid to bring that to the table. And I saw the frustration sometimes when life could be simpler and the movie could be better.
Right.
And I also say there are no stupid ideas. There are only stupid directors. So, you know, even an idea that we don't use might open the discussion to other ideas. And
right.
And I'm a big fan of that. And, of course, I'm a very cast-dependent director. And I've had a lot of great cast in all my films, who have done a spectacular job, and I really owe them a lot of my rise in the film community.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is your, and I know that you hear it all the time, do you feel that that is your special gift for recognizing the potential of the talent that you recruit for your films?
I think if any of those, I mean, I think of any of the people in St. Elmo's, or I think of Demi Moore walked in your office when she was 20.
Mm-hmm.
And you had seen 100 actresses for that role. You would say, thank you, God. That problem is solved. And, you know, a lot of people associate Julia with Flatliners. And, I mean, but it was really Gary Marshall that put her in Pretty Woman.
Yeah.
But Pretty Woman wasn't out yet when we made Flatliners. And so it came out when we were in post-production.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly didn't hurt. But the reason those things happen, I mean, the reason why some of the people in my movies and other people's movies have become overnight stars, because they brought that in the door. What we might have done is given them the role that let everybody see it. That's all.
And you've done it time and time again.
That I'll take credit for. Well, when I started directing, you know, Meryl and Bob Redford were not sitting around going, let's get Joel Schumacher to do Out of Africa, you know. I mean, it was because, you know, I was writing stuff and doing stuff with a lot of young people unknown, and we didn't know St. Elmo's Fire was going to be successful.
Yeah.
The studio said you can't open a movie called St. Elmo's Fire, Joel. No one knows what it means.
Right. But you actually wrote, I'm glad you brought that up, because you wrote St. Elmo's Fire with Carl Kurlander. Was he an assistant of yours previously?
Pardon me? Say it again.
He was your assistant previously, and I'm wondering how that collaboration came about for this one.
Well, he was an intern from Duke University. He came to work with us on the post-production of DC Cab.
Oh, I love that movie.
And thanks. I think we made it for $3 million. And, when I was making DC Cab, the parts that we did in DC, I lived in Georgetown. And I would sit outside on the weekends, and it seemed to me like an entire yuppie city. And, you know, this was in the high heyday of Reaganomics.
I'm there right now. It's still that way, okay? It hasn't changed.
Well, I felt sorry for all these kids because I thought this is an era where you have to have a 25-year plan when you come out of college. This is not the graduate where you can laze around and find yourself.
True. Mm-hmm. That's very true.
It was, and, you know, I was a beneficiary of the 60s, where, you know, kids could come out of college and travel and, like, find out what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
But especially in that era of the 80s, you know, you sort of had to come out of college to be an instant adult. And I thought that was sad and unfair. And I sort of looked at them with a very heavy weight on their shoulders. So Carl, who had become increasingly, you know, part of our little filmmaking family in the post-production of DC Cab, I said to him one day, I always had this idea, and Carl, you know, was fresh from college.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I've had this idea, Carl, when I lived in Georgetown, where there's really nothing been done about graduates since The Graduate, and the times have changed so much. And I said, I want to do a movie about a group of friends who are graduating, and kind of how tough it is to be an instant adult. And so out of that, we started talking, and he had worked at a restaurant when he was in college called St. Elmo's, and then he didn't know what St. Elmo's Fire was. No one did. But I thought, gee, why don't we name the bar that? And there's a famous bar in D.C., which escapes me, which generations have gone to. It's down below. It's too small to shoot in, but it's famous around Georgetown, Georgetown University, and fathers and grandfathers went there. So I thought, well, why don't we make up a bar like that, that's bigger, that we can shoot in, and sort of have life happen around St. Elmo's Bar, and then we can call it St. Elmo's Fire. And so that's how it started out. And then, you know, I based it on some people I knew. Carl brought wonderful memories of, especially in the Emilio Estevez Andy McDowell story, about how foolish his obsession had been with this beautiful girl in college. And, it, you know, I think that was such a great part of the movie. And, and you know, and also, I think I started out with this intellectual idea. This is only my third movie. I started out with this intellectual idea that I was going to make a film about self-created drama. But of course, what I really made a film about is, can you stay together as a group as you get older? Whether you ever went to college or not, everyone could, whether it's high school, whether it's your gang on the corner, whether it's whatever you, your camp, whatever you go through in life, the Boy Scouts or whatever, it's when you think that you'll be best friends forever. And you can't imagine that you could ever not be friends.
That's true.
And life comes in. And you can stay in touch, and then it starts to be Christmas cards and then baby pictures or whatever happened to, or, you know, those stories. And so I think besides how young and talented and beautiful the cast was, it struck a nerve. I also had a real, because I did Cinema Fire and Lost Boys back-to-back. And a part of the philosophy I had was a lot of the youth movies were sort of done like, this is a boutique audience and we don't have to spend a lot of production money. You know, we can do, you know, and outside of John Hughes films, they, a lot of the movies were like, you know, the jock, the whore, the good girl, the, you know, they were very, they were almost exploitational. And so I, what I said to everybody was, why don't we make a movie for young people that's like an A movie? Let's shoot it in scope and let's have, you know, beautiful clothes and great sets and do it like, no one's done a youth movie like that, and and maybe it'll work. We, you know, we had no idea any of this will work. I mean, I'm talking to you about the, it's easy in hindsight to explain this, but this was just a notion at the time, and sometimes you get lucky. And when there were other movies the studio was going to release that summer, and they had had bad research screenings, and we were supposed to come out in October as a back-to-school movie. And then Guy McElwain, who, thank God, greenlit the movie, called me one day and said, do you think you could have this movie ready to distribute in 3 weeks?
Wow.
And I said, oh, I don't know, Guy. And then I remember I hung up the phone, and I actually, I don't know who was in the room with me, whether it was Carl or whether it was someone I was living with or I don't know what, but I said, oh, he didn't just ask me if I could do it. He just told me we're doing it. Gentlemen. So we did the post, the album. David Foster had never scored a movie before. He did that great thing right out of the box. A lot of the groups at the time, Kansas, and a lot of people, I haven't looked at the album lately, so I'm probably going to forget some great people. But they jumped on the album. We did a music video, you know, in a couple of hours and with the cast and clips from the movie. And we opened in June instead of October. So I remember, well, we'd had a fantastic research screening. In fact, the studio not only didn't want the movie to be called St. Elmo's Fire, and I understand that, but the studio wanted me to cut Emilio Estevez and Annie McDowell's relationship out of the film because they thought that Emilio's behavior was too embarrassing, too humiliating.
Wow.
And when we had our first research screening, which was probably, you know, kids from 18 to 25, when Emilio, in his narcissistic mortification, chases Andy McDowell up into the snow, and he's leaving the next morning in his humiliated, in his disheveled black tie, getting in the car, and the boyfriend goes to get a camera to take their picture, which gets a huge laugh, rightly so, and then they're alone, and Emilio throws her backwards over the car and kisses her insanely. And Andy, this was not scripted, Andy does the greatest thing ever in the movie. She succumbs to it.
Mm.
They have a great kiss. And half the audience stood up and cheered.
Wow.
And I remember Guy McElhinney leaning over to me at the research screening and said, you know, Joel, the relationship will stay in the movie.
You know what interests me about, because you're directing a movie about young adults, obviously with young adults, with a group of young adults. Did you base any of these characters on observations you made of them? Because they have to be going through some of the same life changes as these characters, as they're playing them.
Well, Rob was only 19. And, you know, he was, you know, beautiful and wild and reckless and doing some amateur filming himself, which eventually caught up with him. So he was a, sort of the...
You had to bring that up.
no, but I mean, you know, and Rob was only 19. He was the youngest
right.
person in the cast.
That's true.
And I didn't want to put him in the movie and in that part. And he stopped me.
Mm.
And finally came to my office on a Saturday. Born in the USA had just come out, because I remember I had the album, and Rob came in and said, I just got that too, and we were doing a Bruce Springsteen, you know, worship.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just started selling himself like crazy, and I thought, why am I punishing this kid? Because this had gone on for a long time. He wants it. No one will ever want this part as badly as he does.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a teen heartthrob, and I thought, that's right, he was fixing something. Okay, thank you, David. Panic. I didn't have my key to my apartment, and they couldn't find it. So, Rob, yeah, I mean, you know, the parts, if you read the original script of St. Elmo's Fire, it's very much what we shot. Emilio and Denise fell in love. Judd was from a very prominent family. I think his mother was a judge.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he was playing that sort of, that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That probably would be one of our senators or congressmen now. And had switched parties from the Young Democrats to work for a Republican because it was better for his career. And
very funny.
I don't think Judd would have ever done something like that. And Mare was nothing like her character. Mare was married with three children.
Wow.
Or she was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
She thought she was going to lose the part because she was pregnant. But in the script, we had always made Wendy chubby.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, that really lovely, kind, warm girl who falls in love with the bad boy.
Right.
You know, that her parents wouldn't approve. No one would approve of him. But they had a special relationship. And it's very sweet at the end, I think. And Mare is such a fabulous actress.
Yeah, yeah.
That she just made it so believable. And so I'm not sure. I mean, there was improvisation, of course. And, you know, to me, in party scenes and stuff, you know, did her own thing and at the bar and, you know, but the me didn't need a lot of encouragement, you know.
Right, right.
And, you know, Allie was just incredible. She was so refreshing and so beautiful, and she's just the kind of girl everyone falls in love with in college. Mm-hmm. And she was great. I loved her. I thought Allie would become a director. She was so interested in filmmaking that she would stand behind the camera and we would let her look through the lens a lot of time and explain what we were doing. So I thought, you know, not only is she one of the great young actresses around, she's going to, because she did the part in Breakfast Club, which is 180 degrees from,
yeah, completely,
you know, Leslie, the part she played. And, you know, she's such a fine young actress and will always be a fine actress. And I thought she was going to wind up as a director. Because I think she'd be great.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me, you've given us so much of your time, and I really appreciate it.
I
let me just ask you one more question about Sam on the
Spot. A lot. I know.
No, you're terrific. It's the best.
No,
it's one of the best interviews.
Very informative.
When you're approached about the film from fans and so forth, what do you think the legacy of that movie is? What do you think it means to people?
I don't know, because, you know, you don't make movies for yourself. And I'm very fortunate that I've made so many films, and they're on television all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when I come home late at night and I turn on the TV, there's one of my films on. Like, a while ago I came home and A Time to Kill was on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like a home movie, and what you're thinking of is, oh, this is the day that happened, and, oh, this is the time when we thought we couldn't get this scene because it started raining, and, oh, God, then you think, oh, God, is Sandra Bullock beautiful? And then this is the scene where I told Matthew to take the cigar out of his mouth, and, oh, my God, is Matthew beautiful? You know, and then this is a scene that a lot of men have talked about where Ashley Judd is sitting on the floor painting it, dripping in sweat, and her skirt is yanked up pretty far. And, you know, oh, that was the thing when I told Ashley to pull her skirt up, and God, isn't Ashley beautiful? You know, there's a lot of that goes on. And, yeah, so it's sort of not, you know, you make them for other people.
Right.
And it's very hard to understand what effect, because you know what? Every filmmaker works their ass off on every film, mm-hmm. the hits and the misses. So, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes you get lucky and you hit the zeitgeist. You know, maybe if they had held St. Elmo's Fright till October, it wouldn't have been a hit, you know. Who knows? You just don't know. And sometimes you're just at the right place at the right time with the right movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been lucky that that's happened several times in my career, and I hope it hasn't stopped. But, you know, Phone Booth. You know, we made Phone Booth in 12 days with an unknown Irish actor.
Right.
And you know, who knew? For $1.98, and, you know, I mean, you know, we all knew that this is a movie that could go right to the shelf, or we didn't know if we could make it in 12 days. We didn't know anything. I mean, we were just thinking, I think we can. You know, you're always like the little engine, even when you're making the big, it's harder with the great big films, with the big budgets, because, of course, and in all fairness, the studio expects you to make a huge, more money they spend, the more they want in profit. And that's fair. And when they do a movie like Phone Booth, they want to make a very small gamble, and that's fair. So I've done them all. You know, I've done medium budgets, big budgets, teeny-weeny budgets, and, you know, you learn, it's different muscles. You just learn different things from every movie you've worked on.
Well, you've made a lot of films that mean a lot to us, and
yeah.
I just got to tell you, or else my friend is going to kill me. One of my close friends, she wanted me to tell you that Cousins is her all-time favorite film.
Tell her she is a true romantic. I think it's the only truly romantic film I made, except Phantom, but Phantom is really over-the-top romance. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
theatrical romance.
Right.
Cousins is very much about two very, very extraordinary, ordinary people
mm-hmm.
and their families and God, wasn't Isabella beautiful? She still is,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
that film. I hired her because I gave her the part because I thought there's no man in the world that wouldn't fall in love with this woman. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And women always like her too, which is, you don't always get that. And I remember Isabella saying to me, because she hadn't done a lot of acting yet, and she had been a very successful model, and still was. And she had done Blue Velvet and took a lot of shit for it. But as you know, it's not only a genius movie, she was brilliant and very brave.
Mm-hmm.
And right. Right. And she said to me one day, we were talking about the scene we were going to do, and she said, you know, Joel, my mother, which of course you know is Ingrid Bergman,
mm-hmm.
Said to me when I started to act that when in doubt, do nothing. They'll take care of it with the lights and the music. And mm-hmm. I said, that will work if you look like Ingrid Bergman and Isabella Rossellini. I said, if I was on camera, I would have to work my ass off. No. You know, and I said, and your mother certainly didn't do nothing ever. Right. And, and so that was very funny, I thought.
Let me tell you that I would love to have you back on because there's a lot of movies that
yeah.
Flawless, Veronica Guerin. I mean, it goes on and on and on
yes,
that we'd love to talk to you about.
Be my pleasure. I think they should release Falling Down again. I think it's even more.
It's more relevant now than ever.
Yeah,
now.
I mean,
I've been
my
saying
God.
After 4 years now. Yeah.
You know, and yeah. Well, we can talk about all of them. You know, even the ones that where I didn't do my best job. I mean, that's fine with me. You learn
yeah.
a lot from those too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, yeah. What's coming up for you? I know that you're busy. You had 12,
yeah, 12
premiere
12,
at Sundance.
12 is coming out July 2nd, and
oh,
it's
cool.
another young cast. It's from Nick McDonald's very controversial bestseller.
That's right.
Of the
yeah.
same name, which he wrote when he was 17, and it's really beautiful, talented people. Acting bad.
Right.
And it's really, it's a sliver of what's going on. And all. It happens to be privileged kids on the Upper East Side because that's what Nick grew up in and that's
right.
what he wrote about. But it's happening everywhere. It's just, you know, young people who, again, know too much too soon.
Mm-hmm.
All their idols are badly behaved and get more famous for being, you know, badly behaved than they do for good.
Mm-hmm.
And materialism over real values. And, you know, the worst part is the kind of recognition today is more important than accomplishment.
True.
Right. That's
right.
Very true.
So it doesn't matter what you're famous for. You're just famous.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like all the reality shows where people display despicable behavior, but they're famous.
Mm-hmm.
And they go on red carpets, and they get free handbags, and, you know, they get designer gowns and clothes, and, you know, and so... And with all the scandals all the time with sports people, with politicians, with movie stars, with, you know, everybody, it's we sort of accepted that behavior as the norm.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's really not shocking anymore.
It's not shocking because we just have the camera's on all the time now.
Yeah.
Well, when you look at something
good, I mean, part of that I really like. I mean, I like that they can. Yeah, I like that they have surveillance cameras, and when some woman is raped or someone is mugged or killed, that they've got this tape they can run on television constantly, so that maybe someone will catch this person. Yeah, I like that. I mean, I think a lot of being on camera all the time is very healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I think, though, if you're going to let people into your private life and then be either encouraged or let loose to display the worst behavior possible to an audience, and it becomes very, very successful doing that, that I think it, you know, I think that part of it, as fun as it might be to watch that, it's, I remember when Anna Nicole Smith, the poor Anna Nicole Smith, had that program on.
Yeah, I remember that.
And they would, you know, which everybody made fun of, and, you know, she was really, you could tell, stoned and out of it most of the time. You know, they would always cut for a couple of minutes to Danny, the 13-year-old,
mm-hmm.
and you would think, what, how, there's a 13-year-old boy in this house,
mm-hmm.
and his mother's kind of a joke, and... Well, and you see where that all went. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
you
and
know,
they want to push that image, too. I mean, it's like a feeding frenzy. It's almost, I think it almost appeals to the worst instincts in all of us. That kind of voyeurism.
Of course.
Yeah,
it's like it's really like slowing down to see how really awful the accident is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then we can say, oh, isn't that terrible?
Mm.
But we want to see it.
Yeah.
I know. Well, we all share this, so I don't know. I mean, I sound like an old man now, but anyway. So that's what the movie's about, and there'll be a lot of tongue-clucking. There was, you know, Cinema Fire did not get a good review in the United States of America. Not one.
They kind of, I wanted to ask you about that, and then I promise I'll let you go, because the critical reception of it, it kind of, boxed it in as being a portrayal of arrogant, egotistical kids, and that's unfair. I'm sure you felt the same way.
Well, but that's part of the point of the movie. I remember people being, the scene where Denis goes to the shelter where Mara's working, wearing these very expensive clothes, and Ali Sheedy is dressed in all this expensive Ralph Lauren, and, you know, there are homeless people there. And they're, except for Mayor, they're kind of oblivious to it all.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was, the whole scene and the girls and me were like, oh my God, look what they've done. They put these, well, that's the point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mike Nichols said they always confuse content with intent.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's very true.
Yeah. And so that will happen on this movie, too, because it shows really bad behavior, and it'll seem like I'm promoting that. So it can't be. But this movie, Roger Ebert really got, and he wrote a very fair and brilliant review of it. So, you know, I think it certainly won't be like St. Elmo's, where I think that was really... There are critics now that interview me and tell me, you know, Joel, my favorite movie you ever made is St. Elmo's Fire. And I said, no, you hated it. No, I loved it. So go back and find your review. You hated this movie. Right. But I love that. I mean, fine. You know, I didn't have a problem when they hated it, and they don't have a problem that they love it. I'm happy they do.
It means that your movie has lived, and that's the greatest compliment for a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Well, you just hope to have a few of those in your lifetime, you know, and then you always have to live by hoping you haven't made your best film yet, or else you should quit.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, so, I cannot wait to see 12.
And yeah, likewise.
Anytime you can come back,
I hope you like it.
Yeah, please come back.
I hope you like it.
We got a lot to talk about, too.
Thanks. You guys have had to please, thank you so much for spending this time. I hope I didn't talk too much, but we can talk even when we're not like doing an interview. So you guys are great, and I want to know all about you too. So please keep in touch, and thank you very much for your attention on me.
Thank you so much, Joel. I hope to talk to you soon.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Quick, what's the meaning of life?
Dale Beaverman.
Who?
Dale Beaverman. Didn't you see her at the hospital tonight? She's a girl that I was madly in love with when we were freshmen. Okay, she's about yay tall. Long, dark hair, beautiful face. Okay, remember? Remember that big fountain, the one on main campus, the one that says knowledge, art, religion, life? The day that we were walking past that, she was sitting on the life side, and she just smiled at me.
What are you talking about? You took her to one movie.
Kevin, there are several quintessential moments in a man's life. Losing his virginity, getting married, becoming a father, and having the right girl smile at you.
I'm not going to live through another year of finding your poorly written unmailed love scratchings around this house.
Jing, I have her hospital schedule. True love, my friend.
Love. You know what love is? Love is an illusion created by lawyer types like yourself to perpetuate another illusion called marriage, to create the reality of divorce and the illusionary need for divorce lawyers. Just can't deal with the little missus. Can I crash? You know, there are more people in law school right now and there are lawyers on the entire planet. Think about that.
You're just pissed off and bitter because you have not had sex in how long? What is it, a year, maybe 2 years? Refresh my memory, please, Kevin. Haven't you ever heard of the sexual revolution?
Who won, huh? Nobody. Used to be sex is the only free thing. No longer. Alimony, palimony. It's all financial. Love's an illusion.
It's the only illusion that counts, my friend.
Says who?
Anyone who's ever been in love.
Love sucks.
So does your attitude.
Yeah, so Todd Phillips, you've read all about The Hangover, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the tremendous advance buzz on The Hangover. They're saying that this is pretty much guaranteed to be the sleeper hit, even though that nothing's guaranteed, but the sleeper hit of the summer.
I don't understand how that works, sleeper hit, because, you know, people are expecting big things from it, I think. So a sleeper hit just seems so odd, but... You know, I guess after, you know, the last couple of films, maybe, yeah, this is the sleeper hit. But I don't know, dude, it just looks so funny. I mean,
yeah,
it just looks so funny.
Yeah, and they've been doing tons and tons of screenings all over the place in trying to get the word out about this film, and it's worked.
Mm-hmm.
And Todd Phillips, of course, Road Trip, Old School, some great raucous mm-hmm. kind of comedies. Mm-hmm. And it was a great thrill to speak with him. And he was great.
Yes, he was.
This is an interview done by all three movie geeks, myself, Jerry, and our home theater correspondent, Arenado Diaz. Let's go ahead and play this.
Let's do it.
All right, man.
My first question is that, starting with Frat House, or even maybe a little before that, but you've specialized in ensemble comedies, focusing on alpha male type characters, and I was wondering why you think you're drawn to this specific male dynamic.
Probably because I grew up with all women in my household, not to overanalyze it, but I didn't have a dad growing up, and I always found it interesting why men, you know, heterosexual men hang out with each other and have these kind of bonds, and a lot of my films have kind of been an investigation into that in a weird way, and something about that's always been really funny to me. There's an awkwardness to how men, heterosexual men, relate to one another. There's always this sort of uncomfortable undertone to it, and that always makes for comedy in my mind. I don't know why.
Right. And this particular film, you know, it almost seems inevitable that you know since this is you deal in this type of kind of male ensemble, that you know sooner or later you're going to do a film where Vegas was kind of a backdrop, and
right.
And I was wondering, what did you see in this material that kind of differentiated from all the other kind of Vegas-centric kind of comedies we've gotten over the last decade or so?
Yeah, well, for me, it was the way the story was told. What intrigued me about this was making a movie about an event where you never see the event. You know, in this case, the event being a bachelor party in Vegas, but it could have been anything. And the idea of like, and then how Vegas ties into that, quite honestly, is just Vegas is a place where bad decisions are made every minute by everybody. And it just felt, again, like kind of a ripe ground, a stage and set of comedy in. But the challenge of it was exactly that, was making a movie where you don't actually see the thing that happened, and instead you're living in the aftermath of these bad decisions.
Right. And was that always from draft one, was that always going to be the structure of it?
That was. That was always in the original structure, yeah.
And was there ever a moment where, the you know, maybe some executives or someone said, you know, maybe we could do a couple of flashbacks, or did you...
No, it wasn't like that. It was very much about, you know, in a weird way, the movie's more like a detective story than anything. And there are little clues that, you know, they come across these little clues as the movie goes on, and those little clues lead them to piecing together what happened. And in some ways, it's like a very, it's like Memento for dumb guys.
Well, I got to ask about this, the ensemble in that, and particularly Zach and Ken Young, who comes kind of a secondary character who comes into the foreground and kind of steals the film. And I was wondering, what was the process of getting this ensemble together, and how did you know that these particular actors were going to click?
You know, you never know, but you definitely, you know, to me, it's the biggest part of directing a movie is, you know, when they work because of the chemistry with the actors, whether it was Road Trip or Old School or Starsky. Honestly, when my movies work, it's because of the great chemistry between the actors. And Zach was my first sort of piece of the puzzle. I'd known Zach for years just through watching him do his stand-up, and it's not even stand-up, it's more like performance art. And I always wanted to find a role for him, and the character of Alan that he plays is uniquely left-footed and really fits Zach in a way. And as far as Ken Jeong, I agree with you. He does steal a lot of the movie. He's so funny and so out of nowhere, quite literally, in the movie that, you know, Ken is somebody I've been developing this other movie with. Obviously, he's had some roles in other films, and he's been great in those. So I knew him through those movies, and we've been developing this little project together for a little while. And we became friends, and I just wanted to put him in this movie.
And I'll ask the I'm sure everyone's going to ask this. I'm sure they've asked you already. What was the process of getting Mike Tyson, and what were, you know, those days working with him like?
Well, the process of getting him was not as hard as I thought it would be. You know, you immediately think it's going to be a tough guy to get to, and maybe he won't get the joke. We sent the script to his manager, and then Mike called me. His manager called me first, and Mike called me, and we talked about, he loved it. And the weirdest part is Mike is the hugest Old School fan ever. He quotes Old School more than like 15-year-old kids that come up to me in an airport. He knows Old School backwards and forwards. And so he got it, and he got that the joke wasn't on him, but instead the joke was on people's perception of Mike. And to have him on set, you know, I was a little nervous. He's not an actor, he's a boxer, but he came ready to play, and he really was into fucking around in a good way, how you want to fuck around on a comedy set.
Right. And so was the Phil Collins sing-along, was that from script, or was that something that...
No, that wasn't in the script either. That was something I thought of to do after we shot our first day with Mike. I realized, boy, man, he's pretty good. We should give him something a little more active to do, and a little bit something more non-Mike Tyson to do. You know, you just wouldn't picture him singing Phil Collins, so it just seemed funny to me.
Who the hell are you?
Quiet.
Mike Tyson? This is my favorite part coming up right now.
I can feel it coming in the air tonight.
Hey, of course, my guy.
Oh, Lord. But I've been waiting for this moment all my life.
One more time, guys.
Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord.
And the final kind of character or piece of the acting puzzle that I was really startled to see, and I was quite, I think it's going to be a reminder to a lot of audiences how charming and really fetching she is, and that's Heather Graham, who hasn't been in a film that's going to be on 2,000 screens in a while. So I was wondering, you know, how did that come about? Because she's really she provides kind of a calm and sweetness.
I know, and just like sunshine. She when I look at Heather, I just see sunshine. There's something so sunny about her and her disposition. And you know, listen, I've been in love with Heather since License to Drive.
Right.
You know, she's just the sexiest thing, and it's as if she doesn't age. I don't understand. She just always looks so beautiful. I mean, Boogie Nights was 10 years ago, and she pretty much looks the same in person. So we basically offered the part to Heather, and she was into it, and I was so happy to get her. And yeah, she hasn't been in a ton of stuff, but things that she does do, I think she's always great in, and I think she brings a, like I said, a lightness to it that really helps. Because the movie, in some respects, is funny, of course, but has a darkness under it, you know, that I think is really cool. And I think Heather comes in and adds a certain amount of levity to it.
In terms of the genre that you're most recognized for, the kind of outrageous comedic films, there seems to be a popular trend now to out-raunchy the previous genre film. And I was wondering, do you feel that pressure? Because what it strikes me about your film and reading about it is all the critics talk about the heart that this film has as well.
Well, you know, and they did the same thing with Old School, and quite honestly, they did it with Road Trip. And I think whenever these movies work, it always gives me the chills, but I understand it when people talk about raunchy or gross out, because I never see the movies like that. I see them as real and feeling or grounded in some sort of reality, and, you know, try to come across how friends really treat each other. You know, I have this joke where it's like, you're never nice to your friends. You're nice to people you don't like. Your friends, you can go, hey, man, fucking, you know, it's like you treat them in a certain way because underneath it there's a love. And I think, you know, even, you know, what Judd Apatow does so well is there's heart in those movies. And it's not just because he's Judd Apatow that the movies work. The movies work because he understands that to get away with all that stuff, there needs to be a real love underneath it. Whether it's in Superbad between Michael and Jonah Hill's character, or in this movie. And I think that's when these movies work, that's why they work. And when they don't work, they come off as kind of mean-spirited and not believable.
Right, exactly. And how do you know when it's working when you're on set? Particularly with a comedy, I would think it would be tricky with multiple takes and perhaps to gauge
what's
working and what's not. Yeah,
I mean, that's really the whole job of a director. And that's you know, a lot of people don't even know what directors do in a comedy. They think you just point the camera at funny people and they just be funny. But really what a director is he's a purveyor of tone. And he just makes sure all the comedy that you're doing lives within the tone of the movie that you want to make or that you're setting out to make. So for me, it's just always managing the tone. So even when guys like Zach or Will Ferrell, in the case of Old School or whatever movie, when they go off script and they improvise, and I love improvisation, believe me, we always make sure that it's within the world of the character and the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And with the test screening process, I know you've had test screenings with this film, and I'm wondering what you gain from that, because, again, with the comedy genre, I would think that that process would be particularly valuable.
The testing in a comedy is as important as the casting and the shooting and the editing. I mean, it really is another step. And no matter how big and powerful a comedy director can become, they'll always test their movies, I think. I mean, I would never have the confidence to go, no, this is funny, let's just put it out there. Because you learn so much just in rhythm and pacing by showing it to an audience. And it's the most enlightening and the most stressful time of making the film, believe it or not. It really is. But stuff works that you don't think is going to work, and stuff doesn't work that you thought was going to kill. And more importantly than even specific jokes, it just enables you to really hone in on the rhythm and the beats of a movie. And I think part of the thing why Hangover works is it's really tight. And it has that tightness because of, you know, test screenings and constantly sculpting it.
Well, and it's got just a fantastic reaction, and there's a lot of buzz around the film. And I'm wondering if that puts extra pressure on you, if you're feeling that.
No, I love it. You know, honestly, I think any filmmaker loves a buzz around their film, anything to kind of separate out of all the white noise in summer movies that summer movies can make. In a weird way, I think when there's buzz surrounding a film, the only pressure that the only people that feel the pressure are the people marketing and selling the movie, the studio.
Right, right.
And I like that pressure for them because they know the movie works. Now they got to figure out to sell it the right way. And I think they've been doing a stupendous job, by the way, but I think that's the people that ultimately feel the pressure because so often in the movie business, you know, there's a little deception involved sometimes in selling a movie. It's not always what you're selling. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But with this film, I really feel like we're selling the movie. And the funny part is somebody at Warner's, one of the studio guys said to me, the best ad for this movie is the movie. There's no trailer we can cut that is going to be better than how the movie plays with an audience. So we've done 300 screenings around the country just showing it to people so they can go out and tell their friend. You know, it's like that word of mouth thing. When you have a movie that plays well, you just want to put it out there as much as possible.
Yeah, and that word of mouth, man, it's going around. It's getting pretty loud. So I know.
I almost feel like, God, I wish the movie would come out already before the backlash starts.
Exactly. Okay, I'm going to turn you over to Jerry for the close of the interview.
Thank you.
Todd, it's Jerry. It's very nice to meet you.
You too.
Very nice. Yeah, I'm the black sheep in the Movie Geeks United family. I have to tell you, you've done... In 2003, February 2003, I saw Old School in the packed sneak preview in Los Angeles. And it was probably the first time since the early 80s I'd been in the movie theater. I go to see the movies like 400 times a year.
First time,
the early 80s, where the whole audience was just could not stop laughing. And it really had become apparent, even more so than Judd Apatow, that you were really the heir to subversive humor, the great subversive comedies of Harold Ramis, Ivan Reitman, all those guys, the truly great comedies of my childhood. And I just want to know, what kind of influence did they have on you growing up? I mean, I would say the impact is enormous.
Yeah, I mean, I jokingly say, I've said this before, I like to pretend like I grew up watching Preston Sturges and Billy Wilder, but the truth is I grew up on Stripes and The Jerk and Blues Brothers and, yeah, John Landis, Ivan Reitman, Harold Ramis. Mm-hmm. Those were the guys, I mean, I don't know how old you are, but those were the guys that I also went to the movies every weekend as a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old, and those were the movies I would see. And I love those man on a mission or men on a mission comedies and the slobs versus the snobs mentality.
Of course. And
it's just those are huge, huge influences. I mean, I think The Jerk and Blues Brothers and Stripes were probably my three most seminal films. But yeah.
Oh. Without a doubt. No, my mom took us to see Animal House on opening day, and I think I was 6 years old, and the woman at the ticket office said, aren't you afraid this film will damage your son? And my mom was like, that's none of your fucking business.
Your mom is cool.
Yeah. No, so my thing is, though, dealing with Animal House, you made probably the first film since Animal House that really went into, like, the fraternity, or at least the, you know, the guy, a men's health lifestyle.
Yeah.
The let's use men's health as the be-all, end-all of the guy's lifestyle, and did it well, and you didn't feel the need to imitate it. You created your whole new iconography of dialogue and architecture. But my thing is, going back to the documentary, Frat House, I'm curious. You know, Frat House is a very serious film, but you managed to take a lot of the comedic elements of a fraternity life, and they obviously play in Road Trip, Old School, and it looks like in The Hangover. What is it about the fraternity life that appeals to you?
Well, you know what it is? It's back to what I was saying earlier, which is like I grew up with three women, and my mom always told us to be unique and to stand out and to never be part of a group, to be honest with you. And I've been fascinated with guys that feel this need to be part of a group. I never understood it. And so it's funny because people that don't know me think, oh, he must be like a fraternity guy. It must be like the kind of thing. He's like that guy. And it's so not who I am. It's actually I'm just fascinated with the man and their need to belong to a group, to not be identified, to not be identified on their own, but to instead be labeled by a group, even back to fucking Little League. You know, it's like I never understood that sort of mentality. So for me, it is very much exploration of that. I just found that. I found that just unbelievable to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. My other question, though, is how do you do it? How do you know with some of these actors you've given them, like, career-making performances or career-reviving performances? You were really the first director to really take advantage of Vince Vaughn's comedic talent since Swingers with Old School. Or you're the first director to get Will Ferrell, everything that he showed us in Saturday Night Live, to bring that out on the big screen. And especially in Road Trip with DJ Qualls. I don't think he was ever better than he was in Road Trip. Tom Green, he was very good there. And Breckenmeyer, especially. And Snoop Dogg in Starsky and Hutch. I mean, everyone makes fun of that, but let's be very honest. He's hysterical in that movie. But how do you know? How do you get this out of them? Everyone shows up and gives them their best work for you.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that, and I do think with Zach, it's going to be the same feeling. People are going to go, where the hell did this guy come from? He's been around forever, and he's even been in movies, but he's never really been used correctly. And I just think, for me, it's like I hone in on what attracts me to them in the first place, into their comedy in the first place, and I really, maybe it's because I'm also a writer, but I build the part for them. I literally, jokingly, I say it's like the Franklin Mint, where we handcraft it for this person. So we created this brother-in-law character in the Hangover for Zach, because I know Zach is left-footed, and I know Zach, pretends like he wants to belong but never does belong, and he's always just sort of on the fringe. So you kind of build the part a little bit more around the actor, and then you just let the actor come and do what they do so well, and then and on top of that, you just keep going at it until they give it to you, honestly. And, actors want direction, and actors want to do great. I mean, they like that more than anything. And I think, it's a process. It's my favorite part of the whole thing, honestly. It's like, and it's also my proudest thing is like hearing that, like, oh yeah, you took Vince and you put him in a big thing and you made people realize this guy's fucking hysterical, because Vince is one of the funniest people in the world. So that is what attracts me to even scripts or ideas, is like, boy, this will be really castable in a way. I could really crush this and bring some new faces into this and just show people, like, just blow them away. I think Ed Helms, same thing in this movie. I think he's going to be, people are just going to really, like, put him on their lists. And it's just really satisfying to do that.
Right. Does Zach have, like, the Frank the Tank persona in this film? Is that, does he like steal every scene he's in?
Have you not seen the movie yet?
No, I'm not sleeping with the right people. I didn't get to see the screening, so I'm sleeping with the wrong people.
Honestly, I mean, I don't know, the guys you're with, I think, saw it, or honestly, I think Zach is, if you want to call it that, he's the Frank the Tank of the film, and he comes up and he created a character, or we created a character together, the same way Will created Frank the Tank.
Mm-hmm.
He inhabits this guy in such a unique way. And again, a bachelor party movie in Vegas doesn't sound unique at all, but the fun thing about The Hangover is it's not what you think it is in a lot of levels. And I think even in the acting level of what Zach brings to it, and Ed and Bradley, we just treat it a lot better than what you think it would be treated as. You know what I mean?
Sounds like you made the Reservoir Dog film of bachelor party movies in Vegas. I mean, the bachelor party's never, it's like the heist. It's never mentioned, it's never shown in the film. So, you already got it over everyone else who's made a bachelor party film.
I think this is the last word on bachelor parties for a long time.
It sounds like it. My last question, is there anything you can share with us about Old School Dose?
I could share everything with you. I mean, really, it's like, Scott Armstrong and I, who's my writing partner, we wrote, I think, a fantastic script for Old School Dose, and we got it to the guys, and quite frankly, it's a little bit of a victim of, and this is going to be boring, but it's a little bit of a victim of corporate moves. In other words, DreamWorks got sold to Paramount, and then DreamWorks left and went to Disney. The Old School was a DreamWorks movie, went to Paramount, and then got stuck at Paramount because DreamWorks couldn't take it with them to Disney. And the executives at Paramount just don't, it's not in their interest necessarily to put that film on top and to make all the planets align that have to align to get Vince Vaughn and Will Ferrell and their schedules all synced up to do this movie. Now, that said, if Vince and Will were both dying to do the movie, we'd be able to put that together. So, in fairness, it's been hard to engage with Vince on this. He's doing his own thing right now, which I like, and I like the things he's been doing. So, quite honestly, I'm not sure that we're going to see that anytime soon. And if we don't see it soon, we might never see it. But I love those guys and hope to do other stuff with them, but maybe Old School 2's, maybe Old School 2 is not in the cards.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Cool, guys.
Todd, man, thank you so much, man. We wish you the best of luck with the movie, and you're great. Come back anytime.
Thank you. Yeah, you're the best.
Thank you. That was a great interview, guys. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this episode of the Best of Movie Geeks United. You can access our entire archive of over 700 filmmaker interviews by visiting moviegeeksunited.net.